Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, this is for the G's and the geeks, especially the G's who are like...
A show for savers, investors, and entrepreneurs, helping you to stay informed, invest wisely, and achieve the unimaginable. Now, on to the show.
So, Glenn, what's on your mind this week?
Well, you know, probably the two biggest things that dominated the headlines this week were, A, you had inflation going up at a 6% clip, which is the fastest rate of growth that we've had since the early 90s. And, you know, clearly that sent markets into a tailspin earlier this week, where you had somewhat of a minor sell-off in the NASDAQ and the S&P and the Dow Jones. I think the NASDAQ was down close to 2%. Tech stocks were kind of taking a beating. Interestingly, financials and energy did okay, and you still have Brent crude and WTI trading, in the low to mid 80s, which is still near probably 6-year highs, 5 to 6-year highs. I'm not sure of the exact number. But then the second biggest thing, which is really interesting, I think, is that you have another electronic vehicle maker going public, this time with actual production, and you're not just pushing a car down a hill and letting gravity move it like you had in the case of Nikola. That's what it was. Yes, Nikola. And they basically came out and said they had no competitive advantage to any other electronic or just normal auto manufacturer, and so that kind of put the kibosh on that company going public. But Rivian, which actually does make real cars and they make real trucks, they just haven't actually produced one yet for the public. But it went public this week, and it now has a valuation of $110 billion. I just saw on the screen pop up, which is higher than Ford and higher than GM, and is behind Tesla, which has a $1 trillion market cap valuation, which is pretty mind-boggling in itself. So those were two things that kind of caught my eye this week and were a little bit differentiated from what we've seen in the recent past. One other interesting thing is that Ford has a sizable stake in Rivian. And over the past 6 months, I think Ford is up north of 50%. So that's clearly been a good thing for that stock. But, you know, you have all the big automakers. And actually, I was listening to a call this morning, and they were talking about Volkswagen, which owns Audi, and they are going to be the largest producer of electronic vehicles by volume. If they're not already, they will be soon once they, I guess, ramp back up their production post-COVID. So that would be an interesting one to look out for, especially with some of the valuation metrics that are being slapped on these companies that are electronic vehicle makers. So those were two things market related that really, I think, dominated the headlines this week and were pretty interesting. I'll pose the question to you. What were things that you were looking at and what caught your eye?
You know, from where I sit, like you mentioned, the Rivian thing was pretty interesting. I think the big takeaway for me out of that was just how much the investing public is clamoring for ESG investments. ESG meaning environmental, social, and governance. So these are stocks that follow environmental, social, and governance factors in the way that they run their business. So I know major firms like BlackRock are really pushing hard on ESG. Vanguard's getting into the game in a big way. Fidelity, same thing. So you have all these major asset managers just clamoring for these ESG type investments. And you have that coupled with sort of the meme stock generation, people wanting to buy the next Tesla, rocket ship to the moon, Wall Street bets type people. Wanting to get in on the ground floor on some of these stocks. And so sort of the combination of those two things just sent that IPO, this share price to the moon, which is just wild to me. You know, I didn't take part in it personally. I just sort of watch from the sidelines. It's a little too rich for my liking, but then again, you know, Tesla's in the S&P right now and it makes up a pretty large chunk of it at this point. And I would have said that that stock's a little overvalued as well. So who knows? That's kind of the thing that I've been watching. Other than that, you know, the Wall Street Bets kind of crowd is still pumping and dumping various stocks. That's been interesting to watch. Some more little satellite positions, the AMCs of the world. So the big news in AMC land, the big theater chain, is that the CEO liquidated a bunch of his shares, which I understand was part of a systematic distribution policy on his birthday or something like that. So it wasn't that he just looked at the valuation and said, I'm going to get while the getting's good. It was more systematic than that. But, you know, whenever I see stuff like that, when a stock is trading at a really, really rich valuation and I see insiders selling the stock, that always makes me feel a little uncomfortable. And we got the same thing this week with Elon Musk and Tesla, where Elon Musk put out a Twitter poll asking his Twitter followers if he should sell his stock. And he subsequently sold several billion in his stock. And again, do they know something we don't know? anytime insiders start selling at rich valuations, it always gives me pause.
No, I totally agree with that. And, you know, it's always tough to pick tops and you know, nail the bottom. But certainly with broad market cap indices and a lot of individual stocks trading at all-time highs, once you start to see significant C-suite insider selling, generally they might know something that the rest of us don't. So you're right. Can be taken as a sign that should be looked at and maybe a little bit of concern. One thing I want to digress and maybe go down the rabbit hole a little bit. You talked about ESG, and you know, that's something that I've always kind of been perplexed about, just broadly what ESG is, what constitutes ESG, and how different companies fit in. And my problem with it is that there, I feel like you can always poke holes in a company or an asset class or a strategy, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's Apple, whether it's Tesla. And, you know, you can look to things and say, well, maybe they have some parts of ESG, but or that are ESG compliant or, you know, should be looked at favorably by people who follow an ESG investment policy. But then there's other things about, you know, those same companies that definitely wouldn't fit the mold, in my personal opinion. And, you know, like in the instance of Tesla, yes, obviously they're electronic vehicles. It's good for the environment. It's not using fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, on the flip side, OK, what is the amount of carbon emission that is used to mine all of the metals that go into making the batteries? I mean, how do you quantify that? And then on the flip side, you know, they do a lot of business in China, and China doesn't have the best social policy that would, you know, check that box. And then also they don't really follow environmental policies very well, as they're the largest emitter of greenhouse emissions in the world as from a country standpoint. So how do you look? I know you've had conversations with a lot of institutional managers that actually manage ESG strategies. What are your thoughts on that? How do you kind of look at that? Is it We look at it as who does it the best, as far as maybe they don't check all the boxes, but they check the most boxes, or which one is the best at doing it? Or should it be looked at as kind of you have to follow all of the principles of ESG and it's more all or nothing?
Yeah. So on that point, anybody that's interested, I urge you to go back and look at the podcast we did with Megan Fielding from TIAA Kraft/Nuveen. She sort of heads up the responsible investing area for that group. And so, you know, again, just go back, listen to the podcast, listen to what she says. But to directly answer your question, there is no answer. We're still sort of in the early game. So on that podcast, I specifically asked Megan the question, how do institutional managers look at certain companies that maybe they aren't the ones producing, you know, whatever nasty stuff that they're that it takes to produce a widget, but maybe they outsource it to China. And so when examining ESG or a company's compliance with sort of ESG standards, how deep do you go? You know, you have this product company, let's say they make phones, for instance, and they outsource all the nasty parts to emerging markets countries. And so the company here in the US receives the product and no, technically they don't have to pollute to make their phone, but somebody else is doing that on their behalf. So how deep do you go? And I don't think there's a clear answer. Everybody does it differently. In terms of guidelines, the MSCI actually has baseline ESG suitability metrics that they look at. And those, I believe, have sort of become the standard. But again, you know, how deep do you go? You know, another way I look at ESG, so typically a lot of ESG managers, when they're managing a mandate, they use ESG standards to exclude certain companies. So let's just say they're a greenhouse gas emitter. They are excluded from being in the investment portfolio. But another way to look at it is sort of prospectively, you know, what about companies that are solving for a problem? What if there's a pharmaceutical company that is searching to solve a disease like diabetes or Alzheimer's? I mean, to me, that seems like that would be very ESG friendly. But again, I don't know how that fits into the broader guidelines. I think the major takeaway for us at this point in time is that there is no one standard. You know, there's standards that are potentially looking to be imposed, but nobody's doing it the same. There's no clear answers. To me, I think a lot of it tends to be more marketing than anything. It's asset managers having something that they can talk about and pat themselves on the back and feel good about to go and sell their products to other people.
Gotcha. Yeah, that to me, it seems to be kind of, you know, maybe if there's a internal scoring methodology that firms use, likely no one company is going to score 100, meaning that they would be following every single ESG policy that you can to a perfect T. But maybe it's like you said, which one is has good intentions and is doing things in a way that would be looked favorably upon. And, you know, I guess there's some sort of scoring criteria that's used by these managers to pick companies. So that's just always been kind of a fascinating thing to me, because it's like if everybody is ESG, then nobody's ESG, right? So if there's not some way to kind of hard and fast say these are things that must be met in order to be recognized as an ESG company, then, you know, as well as I do, narratives can be construed in any way you want. We see that in Washington every single day, where you know, sometimes reality and the truth are different beasts. And so that's always been an interesting kind of aspect of the investment landscape, is how ESG can be kind of interwoven into different narratives with companies.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. From where we sit, we obviously speak to a lot of different investment managers. And as this trend has become more popular, what has really just been hilarious to me is all these asset managers that, you know, we've worked with for a long time or have known for a very long time, all of a sudden now they go, oh, well, ESG was actually part of our process the whole time. We just didn't have a name for it.
Right. Kind of like, you know, inflation is a bad thing until it's a good thing, because it now has to fit your narrative.
Exactly. Well, speaking of inflation, that's the other big news. You actually just put out a blog post on inflation after the hotter than expected read we got inflation this week. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, I did. And that was just kind of a brief snippet, just looking at historically, you know, where we've been and where we're at now. But I kind of find this inflation debate to be kind of funny, because you have, like I said in the blog post, you kind of have two very entrenched camps of are we in an inflationary environment, or is this just a shorter term kind of blip and we're going to go back to more of the deflationary environment that we've seen really for the past 8 to 10 years, really coming out of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. And from my standpoint, I actually could care less. I don't have some sort of philosophical view that we're inflationists or deflationists. I'm just more interested in what is the current regime doing. And I think that this kind of touches on a little bit of how we look at investing portfolios for clients too, is, you know, all right, let's look at and evaluate what the current landscape is and position around what those expectations are. And so clearly, the research that we've been looking at has led us to the conclusion that we're going to see inflation. And simply, you know, it's a mathematical exercise, because when you look at 2020 and how bad things were, both from a growth and inflation perspective, the math was telling us that, yeah, we're going to see inflation in 2021. I mean, when you have negative oil prices on futures contracts, because there's way too much supply and not enough demand, from a mathematical standpoint, when you go against that negative number, the growth is going to look like it's off the charts. And it was. And so what's interesting is that you have these very high, I mean, they're highly educated, highly intelligent people, whether they're at the Federal Reserve or they're economists at think tanks in Washington, D.C., or they're working for some of the largest institutions that manage, you know, the billions and trillions of dollars. And for some reason, I guess they just couldn't see or understand that this was going to be coming in 2021. And so they're all now kind of adjusting their forecasts to say, oh, well, you know, maybe this might be something that is a little bit longer than we anticipated. And so to me, I kind of ended that blog post saying, you really have to question the credibility and the accuracy of a lot of these people, just on the fact that, you know, they've so poorly missed this inflationary move, which is translated, if you've been invested appropriately and correctly with that view, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made. Luckily, the research that we subscribe to and the people that we use their economic research to help us formulate our investment decision making, you know, they were right. And so that was good for us to have exposures like that in the portfolio, because they paid handsomely. So, yeah, at some point we'll probably be in the deflationary camp. And I think that that's the kind of mindset that you need to have. You should be able to go both ways and have a view that, okay, you know, mathematically we're going to see inflation, and what does that do to markets? And then, because we had such high inflationary numbers in 2021, you're likely going to see inflation growth slow. And, you know, I don't think it's going to go negative where you're going to have outright deflation, but you may have disinflation in 2021, or I mean in 2022 and 2023. And so we will position accordingly and basically change what the portfolio looks like in order to be prepared for that. And so that's kind of the way that I look at things, is I don't need to have this long-term view that we're in one type of environment. I just want to know, what type of environment are we in, or are we going into, and how does that impact different exposures in the portfolio? So I kind of find you can go on Twitter and you can see arguing and spitting matches all over the place with people debating whether or not inflation is here to stay or not, or, you know, we're actually just in a short-term blip and there's deflation. I could care less. I just want to make sure that we have the portfolios positioned accordingly to manage and navigate whatever economic environment we're in.
On that, you know, the Fed is not stupid, right? You know, they have indicated that they expect this inflation to be transitory. Yep. And it's clear certain things were, right? I mean, we saw lumber prices spike up and then they came back down. Are they still elevated to some degree? Sure. But are they way off the highs? Absolutely.
Yep.
You know, when I drive by local car dealerships, so I live outside the metro area. So the car dealerships here locally, when they have inventory, they ship it into the big city. So I don't know that you see this driving around in the metro areas, but there is a shortage of cars and used cars. But many of the major producers I heard just on the news today that they're actually ramping back up production, and they expect production to get back to normal and inventories to tick back up and whatnot. So I could definitely see some things are transitory. You know, other things, like many people have talked about, wage inflation, that's difficult. That's a difficult genie to put back in the bottle, right? If you gave somebody a 10% raise, it's hard to take that back.
Right. Or a 10% wage on what they were making, and they didn't have to go to work. You know, behaviorally, how you kind of round that circle is interesting. And I think it'll be interesting to see how the whole labor dynamic plays out. In my opinion, clearly, your wage inflation was a high probability of occurring simply because over the course of 2020 and 2021, there was a big segment, especially of people that were in service and, you know, maybe some manufacturing and more of the blue collar type jobs who actually were making more money when you factored in all of the different social safety net programs that were being enacted in 2020 and 2021. You've seen all over the country, you know, McDonald's and fast food chains are offering $50 interview bonuses just to show up for an interview. And when in your lifetime, certainly not in our lifetime, I don't think we've ever seen, and I don't know if in history you've ever seen things like that. But I mean, it's like there's bonuses that are you haven't seen, at least in my working years, where to sign on to, you know, become an employee at a company. It's just it's interesting. And I think that, like you said, you know, that genie is really tough to put back in the bottle. And I think that you're probably going to see the wage inflation follow simply because you had an inelastic kind of supplier in the government with these unemployment and other types of social safety nets, which were created and you know, a lot of people were forced into that situation by the government. And so I think it's going to be there'll be some pain to try and get through this as people have to come to the realization that either they need to go back to work or not. And I don't know what that looks like, but that's my two cents on that. I think that you know wage inflation could be a big possibility unless you have a recession and people just start becoming laid off. But you know, who knows what's going to happen, what the government will do at that point. And obviously a lot of it depends on the you know, the administration and who's in Congress. So that's a big seems to be a big question mark too, especially when you see what happened in Virginia and in New Jersey too. Even though the Republican governor didn't win, he was very close, and that was something that was not predicted by a lot of the, you know, political pollsters and pundits. So who knows? There's definitely a lot of question marks.
Totally agree. I think the one thing that is not a question mark, however, is that right now our monetary system, the Federal Reserve, is serving as the backstop to the economy and the stock market. Anytime anything bad happens, they have proven that they will step in and get that printer press running to help smooth out any turbulence in the economy. And so that backstop for the last decade has served as a reason why many investors buy the dip. Anytime the market sells off, buy the dip, because the Fed will backstop it at some point. When one of the things that I thought was really interesting was Luke Grohman from Forest for the Trees. He was on the Macro Voices podcast, which, quick shout out, is one of my most favorite economics podcasts out there. One of the things that he mentioned that I thought was just really interesting is the stat that he threw out was, if you total up interest service on our current debt plus entitlements, that totals to be about 110% of tax receipts. So his point on that podcast is, well, the Fed will continue to assist and through quantitative easing and keeping rates low in perpetuity, because there is no other option. TINA, there is no other option. One of the acronyms of the decade. So that was pretty interesting, a pretty interesting perspective that he had. He basically says that even though the Fed has sort of jawboned, yes, we're going to take our foot off the gas, so to speak, on the printer presses, that it's just jawboning. We can't afford to raise interest rates at this point. And to that point, that's why the Federal Reserve, was it in 2020, moved to the inflation averaging versus just looking at inflation over any fixed period of time, because they knew that we would see inflation and they knew we would be in a spot where we wouldn't necessarily want to do or could do anything about it. We're going to have to let the economy run hot for a little while because we need to pay off all that debt with cheaper dollars.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't disagree with that. And certainly it seems like that's the trend. Who knows? It's difficult to forecast out a year what's going to happen. And I've heard Luke and I've listened to him on many podcasts and I subscribe to his newsletter. And he's a very, very intelligent person. Clearly, you can see that in what he talks about and the level of technicality that he understands how financial markets operate and how they work. But I think that he's talking about a duration of 10 to 25 to 50 to 100 years. And potentially, I mean, who knows? So it's really hard to, I think, time, when those events happen and what's the catalyst. But I certainly don't disagree with his kind of broader theme that the U.S. simply can't raise interest rates because, like you said, the debt servicing and things of that nature. So then, the question is if you just have this perpetual Fed put, is it gold? Is it Bitcoin? Is it digital pictures of a rock? I mean, what do you look at to try and protect, your hard-earned wealth?
Well, I think,
digital rock sounds really interesting. I think, that seems to have a lot of value. They sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. So maybe we need to get in the digital rock formation game.
Digital rock, digital ponies. I mean, digital stick figures, everything.
I fail to see the value intrinsically in things like that.
Well, the value of an object is what the next person will pay for it. So,
exactly. And that's kind of a interesting way to invest your money. It's the greater fool theory. You're hoping that someone is going to be holding the bag when you're ready to offload. And you just hope that you're not the last one standing in the game of musical chairs.
Yeah, you tend to run into these types of problems when you have excess liquidity.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Looking back, hindsight obviously being 2020, it's really not a stretch of the imagination to see that when you force people that they can't work and now they have to stay at home, and in a lot of cases they forced to stay in their homes, they couldn't even leave their homes during the height of COVID, but they were given money in order to survive, and so there was no gambling on sports or anything else that people like to do to, bide their time, and they weren't working. So they had a lot of free time on their hands and they had a lot of money. And, I guess maybe the one good thing is that savings rates are up and a lot of the consumer's balance sheet got better than what it was going into the pandemic. And so I guess, what did you expect these people were going to do with all this time and all this money when traditional financial assets, which degrade, but I guess for some people that wasn't enough. And so speculating on cryptocurrencies and, you name it, whether it's CryptoKitties or Dogecoin, which was they were not bashful about saying that they were a fake cryptocurrency or a, made kind of tongue in cheek. There wasn't really any value, I think, to be made by Dogecoin or by Shiba Inu, which was a fake offshoot of a fake cryptocurrency. I mean, should it be any surprise looking back that this is where we're at when people were not working and had a lot of free time to spend and had a lot of money to blow? I mean, is that so hard to imagine, Z?
No. You know, when people ask me about inflation in the markets, you know, I think it's really this simple. You know, when you print trillions of dollars, some of it's going to end up in the stock market, right? Some of it's going to end up in Beanie Babies or NFTs or Bitcoin or whatever. But anytime you just throw buckets and buckets of money out of the helicopter down to earth, people are going to pick up those dollars and throw it in some direction, right?
Sure.
So last question I had for you, what do you make of these? So this week, J&J as well as GE broke up their businesses. So I guess the businesses are splitting up into separate businesses. What do you make of that?
Well, on one hand, you know, you can kind of look at it as maybe separating out the faster growing or more profitable segments of the business. And so, you know, I guess you could look at that as shareholders or trying to benefit shareholders, where you're more, I guess, distinctly separating out the different lines and having them in different companies that trade publicly. And so the more slower growing or lagging segments of a business are kind of shed, and you can focus on what you may think are the better parts of the business. And so I guess that's a good thing for shareholders on one hand, but on the other hand, I guess you could look and see, well, you know, these companies just got so bloated, and you can blame the people that were previously running the company for not being good allocators of capital and not being very good operators. So, like, and with GE, that stock has just been a laggard for so long. And it wasn't really until Larry Culp came and tried to turn the company around that you've really seen this resurgence in GE. And I think that he's done a great job of operating that company and turning it around. And now it seems like he's wanting to kind of shed some of the fat off of the company and really have the more highly efficient and better operating segments of the business separated, maybe from some of the ones that weren't as profitable or as highly efficient. And so I think it's probably a good thing in the long run. But again, it's kind of interesting that the people that were running these companies, they allowed the these conglomerates to become so huge, where, you know, it became like trying to turn the Titanic. And if there was anything from a strategic initiative that these companies wanted to do, it would be so much to move the needle that it would almost be kind of lost amongst all of the other line items on the balance sheet and the income statement. So probably a good thing, but I guess the market will let us know.
Good deal. Anything else on your mind this week?
No, just going to enjoy a nice, beautiful weekend. I'm here in Pinehurst. It's 75 degrees. This whole week has been absolutely beautiful. And I've been kind of not kicking myself, but wishing I could have been outside a little bit more with how nice the weather has been. So hopefully it will persist into the weekend, and I'll be able to enjoy the outdoors a little bit with what little I think we have left of nice weather to be outside as we get through November and into December, when things traditionally become a little bit more nasty outside. How about you?
Yeah, about the same. You know, we had this nice little break in the weather. I think this is probably going to be the last nice day based on the 10-day forecast before we go into the holiday season. So hope to get outside, maybe do some raking, yard work, that kind of stuff. But we shall see.
Sounds fantastic. I love it. Well, Z, this has been great. I hope that everybody out there listening has a great weekend. We're recording right now on Friday at 1:30. So if you're not already on the golf course or enjoying yourself outside, hopefully you'll get outside and enjoy it, because it sure is beautiful.
All right, Glenn. Till next time.
Likewise. Have a great weekend. Take care.
My raps are raw. I dribble like a basketball. Slobber on myself, but that's all.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to click subscribe. Gordon Asset Management, LLC, is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit wealthqb.com. The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management LLC nor its podcast participants shall not be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.